Many of us have seen it, the emergency room portrayed on television. Frantic, quick decisions to save lives, at the same time a place for end of life. How should emergency physicians address end of life issues? That's the topic on this edition of the Bioethics Channel, a production of the Center for Practical Bioethics. For more information about the center and its programs, go to practicalbioethics.org. That's practicalbioethics.org. Dr. Arthur Dursey joins us. He is Director of Medical and Legal Affairs and Interim Director of the Medical College of Wisconsin's Center for the Study of Bioethics. Dr. Dursey, medicine is a demanding profession, but it seems the emergency physician is especially in the trenches of healthcare. What end-of-life considerations come into play with ER docs in the emergency room?
Well, Laurel, the fact of the matter is that it can be a really frantic place. And the emergency department often is where if someone doesn't expect that they're going to be facing the end of life and they run into a major problem with either trauma or cardiac arrhythmias or cardiac arrest, they end up in the emergency department. So emergency physicians actually do see a lot of end of life situations, in part because that's where people go when there's a true life-threatening emergency, and in part because a lot of the situations that used to arise where doctors would come to someone's home and your primary care physician would be there as you died, that's no longer true. People dial 911, they bring you to an emergency department, and emergency physicians generally are of the mindset that they're going to go ahead and intervene, resuscitate, do something. And I think one of the mottos is don't just stand there, do something, which sometimes is not exactly what we should be doing.
So then the ethics of end of life within an emergency room, issues of patient autonomy, informed consent, do they still work in that kind of environment?
Well, in fact, emergency physicians tended to ignore those. They figured if you were in the emergency department, you have an emergency and you want treatment and you need maximal treatment, and we're going to do everything we can to treat you, to keep you alive, to get you, you know, resuscitated. So in fact, autonomy has not been as, I'd say, well-respected, mainly because there's not a lot of time for discussion, and you figure, hey, we're going to err on the side of, you know, life, and you know, no one ever got sued or in trouble for doing everything to someone in the emergency department. Well, that's the kind of statements that I hear emergency physicians make, and it's no longer true. The original reason for resuscitation in trauma and in cardiac arrest was to be able to turn around these life-threatening conditions in people in which it could be, and it ought to be turned around. But there is another group of patients for which end of life is actually expected. That is that they have a terminal diagnosis, they have a treatment plan with their physician, they realize that it's time to no longer try to cure, but now care and comfort. And yet, because something comes up, there might be something in which relatives go, oh, we're not sure what's going on, let's call the ambulance. Once you make that call, a cascade of things happen. So the paramedics show up. They don't know exactly what's going on. They take to the hospital. The emergency physicians come in. Someone's having difficulty breathing. And, of course, they go, okay, we need to put a tube in this person and start treating them. And so for this new group or this group of patients for whom they've expressed their autonomous choice about what they want to do, it's no longer just assumed that you have implicit consent. It's an emergency. Any reasonable person would want this. And instead, emergency physicians have to do something that's not been in their training and nature to do, and that is to find out whether or not there is an advance directive, there is a plan of care for the patient, whether or not we can comfort the patient here in the emergency department rather than try to turn around the disease, whether or not we can treat pain appropriately, because often in the emergency department, we've not erred on the side of giving enough pain medication. It's just the opposite we're concerned about.
Well, it sounds like we're trying to achieve some kind of a balance in a very difficult situation, a very difficult environment.
Well, we are trying to achieve a balance because, of course, for those for whom they are no longer able to express their wishes and you don't know anything else about them, and you don't have the time to find out about that, you know, you do tend to use what's known as the emergency exception to informed consent, where there's a life or limb threatening emergency, time is of the essence, there's no legal decision maker, We don't know what the patient's wishes are, and a reasonable person under the circumstances would say, sure, go ahead and treat me. So if all of those are true, then the emergency exception or emergency privilege to inform consent allows you to treat people without their consent. But interestingly, not everything that comes in is an emergency, and even if it is, there may be a plan of care. There may be an agreement ahead of time. There may be more information that a physician, a primary care physician or palliative care physician can tell you about this patient. There may be more information that one can get from the hospice nurse if there's a plan ahead of time. And so as part of this training project, we're actually trying to have emergency physicians in the time that is often limited find out, number one, whether or not this particular patient fits into that end-of-life paradigm where it's not a sudden cardiac arrest, but instead it's something that's anticipated. And yes, there was some discomfort, and yes, there's reasons to address that, but no, that's not a reason to throw out the whole game plan and just, you know, do everything willy-nilly without finding out more, finding out from the patient if they're able to speak what their wishes are, and if the patient's unable to speak, try to find out if there's been any expressions or an advance directive or a pre-hospital DNR order that's been agreed upon, all things that generally emergency physicians have not really gone that extra step to do.
The idea of a surrogate speaking for that person is something that's been the subject of a lot of case studies that we've considered here at the Center for Practical Bioethics, and the breadth of issues involved with that are considerable. How is that addressed within an emergency room, perhaps when there's no one there to be able to speak for a person who is facing the end of life?
Well, in the old paradigm, emergency physicians, if they didn't have someone to speak for the patient, would pretty much discount anyone else who came in and said, oh, I'm this person's husband, and I'd like you to treat her with comfort care only. They would go, well, I don't, you know, I've never seen you. I don't know this. Where is it written legally? We're not sure. Sorry, but, you know, we'll talk to you later. We push them out of the, you know, the patient's room or the resuscitation room and say, we'll come and get you later. That has been the paradigm in emergency medicine. And it often worked, you know, because most situations are not end-of-life care situations. But emergency physicians have been less willing to honor and recognize a surrogate authorized by an advance directive, in part because maybe they've lost decision-making most recently, and technically there haven't been two physicians determining that the patient's non-decisional, even though the patient clearly is. Emergency physicians have also been wary about agreeing not to do something. They feel a little, they don't feel as if that's what they've been trained to do. They're somehow, now this patient is not getting maximal care, so what do they do next? And since they haven't been as well trained in comfort care and palliative care and, you know, allowing the withdrawing, withholding in the emergency department and then either making the appropriate move to hospice or allowing it to occur in the ER, that's something that's new to them. And in fact, most emergency physicians are, even though they're used to someone dying in the emergency department, they're only used to it after you have done these heroic and valiant measures. And most emergency physicians aren't prepared to allow a patient who wishes to and whose family understands and everything's in agreement to die in the emergency department. Most emergency physicians are, they want to transfer them, scoot them up somewhere, or act to reverse the problem and let people upstairs in the ICU figure it out, which sometimes can only prolong the dying process and is exactly not what the patient and the family wanted.
You talked about heroic measures. CPR can be considered one of those. That's something that you see on TV and think that it works. It seems like some research has come out recently calling into question the effectiveness of CPR and whether it should actually be used to resuscitate individuals.
Well, the truth is that CPR is something that is like any other tool, any other armament in the physician's array of things that he or she can use. It's something that should be used with discretion. And in the old days, CPR was originally designed for reversible cardiac disease, often in younger people who had, you know, a very good resuscitation outcome as a result. But then it started being applied to absolutely everybody so that everyone was given CPR. And the figures for resuscitation success rates are actually much worse than they appear on television, right? If you watch television, you see that someone has a cardiac arrest, and sure enough, they go through resuscitation,
and
more times than not, they are, because
right.
What Hollywood screenwriter or TV writer wants, you know, 5 out of 6 of those people dying. You know, your storyline ends, and that's the end of it. So, you know, there was actually a very witty review done of all the resuscitations on TV, and it looks like a wonderful thing, and that it works most of the time, when in reality, we emergency physicians, cardiologists, people who really deal with this, understand that it is not, in general, it's not successful, and only about a third of people make it through the initial attempt, and then only about a third of those people will leave the hospital.
Dr. Dursey, you've been talking a little bit about hospice and palliative care and ER docs being trained in this. You've been actively working on that. How's it going? How is it being received within the ER community?
Well, so there's a project called EPIC, which is end-of-life education for professionals in end-of-life care. And there's a special brand for emergency physicians that a colleague named Tammy Quest from Grady and Emory and others are involved in. And we are doing a train-the-trainers curriculum. So we have set as our goal having one person in a residency training program where emergency physicians are trained, being trained in aspects of palliative care in emergency medicine. And so that person can then be the champion in that residency to try to train a new generation of emergency physicians who are more cognizant of this and understand the principles better. And so I have to say that it's exciting work. It is slow going because my fellow emergency physicians are great folks, but they know what works. And, you know, they have often been trained for years, and to have them think about a new way of doing something is sometimes difficult, especially when it has to do more with talking with patients, communicating with patients, interacting with doctors and nurses and families, and allowing people to die. Many of us were trained initially by surgeons who had learned their craft in Korea and Vietnam, and in fact, that's who I was trained by, or at least the chair of our department, had been a MASH surgeon. And, you know, it was all intervention, all the golden hour where, you know, in that first hour of trauma or in that cardiac arrest, if you do the right things at the right time, you can save lives.
That's a different mindset, isn't it?
It's a different mindset. And well, it's a great mindset if you're in trauma. And there's trauma, and, you know, it's a young person who is, you know, out in the battlefield. It works. It's great. And the same is true with CPR applied under the right circumstances. But the problem is bringing that back to a general population, an aging population, and a population for whom there's a subset of patients who now understand that they are facing the end of life, and they don't want all this stuff done to them. And it's hard to do that because when you reach that point, in almost every circumstance, you're no longer able to speak for yourself. And that's now a problem. So if you were awake and alert, you'd say, no, I don't want this. But you're not often. And family members may be saying, no, they would not want this. But as I say, emergency physicians are, you know, they're from the show me state. They want to know, you know, like, who said this? How
right.
is it written? Which lawyer signed it? How do we know that this is? How do we know you're really the wife? How do we know? They're very practical, and they just want the bottom line. And if they can be shown that there is a way to identify this group who is unfortunately dying slowly rather than suddenly arresting or suddenly having a problem, and that they're now having a symptom that can be treated, that, you know, there's a way to intervene to be able to really deliver good patient care that, you know, is within the knowledge set of medicine. And for this new group, this vanguard of emergency physicians, it's seen as something that's legitimate. It's something that is an alternate way to treat a patient who wants to be treated that way, or family members who understand that the patient needs to be treated that way.
Arthur Dersey is a physician and an attorney. He is the Director of Medical and Legal Affairs and Interim Director of the Medical College of Wisconsin's Center for the Study of Bioethics. You've been listening to the Bioethics Channel, a production of the Center for Practical Bioethics. For more information, visit the center's website at practicalbioethics.org. That's practicalbioethics.org. I'm your host, Laurel LeBoux. Thanks for listening to the Bioethics Channel.